election on our own, but we'll try to figure out what the election is going to go. They make an assignment for all of us at the end of the day. Do we know if the people are...
Sandy is on.
We'll go ahead and begin for today. And as you know, the first thing on the agenda today is the conversation about welfare reform. And again, as a reminder, we've been talking about this whole subject based on the impact that welfare has on this program and the impact this program, the welfare program, has had on Medicaid. Because you know that you're inextricably tied when you do your job, it's the best way to do it. And online, we have Sandy Hogan, who is with the American Institute for Full Employment. And then, did you have any remarks beforehand, or do you want to say your remarks so after Sandy talks?
I'll be on it, Sandy.
Okay. Okay, Sandy, I'll let you go ahead and introduce yourself and kind of introduce yourself and give your credentials, et cetera. Are you on there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Loud and clear. Go right ahead, Sandy.
Great. As Senator Green said, my name is Sandy Kovac, and I am a independent consultant, and that's in under contract with the American Institute for Full Employment, which did an assessment of Alaska's welfare reform efforts. My background is I was the former administrator of the Oregon Welfare Agency until the beginning of this year, and then went into consulting. So we were in Alaska this summer for a couple of weeks. We were able to do what I would call an overview. It wasn't an in-depth assessment. We were able to, excuse me, I'm having a little trouble with my throat this morning. We weren't able to do an in-depth review, but I think we hit most of the high points. And I do want to thank the DPA staff, notably Jim Ardland, as well as his deputy, Chris Ashenbrenner. They were enormously helpful. The staff and the contractors were all very candid, and I think we did a pretty reasonable job of hitting the high points of the welfare reform effort. I don't know, Senator Green, if you want me to go through a summary of recommendations, or if you'd rather have Jim comment on those. I'm not sure how you want to proceed.
You want to be there in a second? I'm talking to Jim Rutter in a second.
Senator, I was prepared to talk about the recommendations, and I had a handout for you to follow up on that. So I'm not sure how we want to proceed.
Yeah, my sense of this is that Mr. Nordland concurs with a significant portion of the recommendations, and we have asked that the recommendation be sorted into three categories. One, those that take legislative action, those that are policy direction for the department, and then those that are kind of good practice or whatever. And it would be most useful for me if they could take the recommendations. Sandy could explain the recommendations, and Jim give us what, you know, the department's take on that and recommended actions, and take them one by one. Last, with my senior citizen's memory, if you went through the 20, you know, then I would have more trouble tracking. That would be my recommendation.
Go ahead with what Dyson just said. Go ahead, Sandy.
Hey, do you have the document summary of recommendations sorted the way that Representative Dyson asked? We sent them forward, and I hope they reached you, committee.
Do we have that?
I think so.
Yes, it's in the very back of the...
The back of that section?
Yes.
The right before bioterrorism.
Okay.
The last
We've got them, Sandy.
Okay, great. Well, then, starting with the legislative priorities. And each of these recommendations refer, we try to put them in priority order. And so there's a recommendation number and also a page number, which refers back to the full report. But the first recommendation is to amend the state statute to allow labs to use full flexibility allowed under federal law to extend benefits to some long-term recipients. This is an issue I know the committee is very familiar with because you grappled with it last session. And it has to do with the cap on the percentage of people that could receive an exemption from the five-year time limit. Right now, Alaska law is more restrictive than the federal law. And after we reviewed this rather thoroughly, our conclusion is that you're really putting your state at some risk of federal penalties because unnecessarily. Because at this point, I think it's unclear how many people will justifiably need to be able to be exempted from that time clock. And so our recommendation is to use some very narrow criteria to exempt people rather than an arbitrary percentage cap. And I think you could do that in such a way that would assure you that it's not being abused or overly used by setting up some kind of a legislative review process. And maybe Mr. Norland also has some suggestions about how he would make sure that it wouldn't be overly used. But it seems to make sense from a state perspective, so you're not putting yourself at risk of any kind of federal penalty, to go with some kind of narrowly crafted criteria that would allow you to satisfy your needs as well as to stay in compliance with the federal law. Jim, you want to comment on that?
Did you see the name on the record?
Thank you for the record. My name is Jim Nordland, Director of the Division of Public Assistance. What Sandy Hoback is referring to is the legislation, actually is part of the legislation that was introduced last year and is still, I believe, in your committee, Senator. As Sandy mentioned, it does allow us to, what it will do is take out of the law the strict 20% cap on the number of individuals who can be exempt from the five-year limit. And what the Institute is recommending and what we also advocate is that we look simply at the criteria, whatever they are and however strict they are, and live by those, and however many families fit under that criteria is the number that can be exempt from the five-year limit. We are hamstrung in Alaska because of that 20% cap being in our state law. Many other states don't face that sort of a restriction, so we're just asking that that be lifted. And that and we live by the criteria that would be in regulation as to who would be exempt.
I know they're going to come back and ask us all to speak up because they're having trouble hearing us.
Okay.
And so in the future, we'll just speak a little more.
If I may answer, yeah. Jim, either after each one of these recommendations or at the end of the first category, I think it's legitimate for us to ask you, will the administration then be coming forward with a bill to deal with this?
Sure.
What's the
answer? I think you'll do it by section. Or are you going to do it by
I don't care. Whatever you want,
okay. Okay.
The answer to the first one then is that it's already in the legislature. This particular provision is something we've already addressed.
There's a bill out there?
Yeah. Well, there's the last year there were two governor's bills introduced. It was the House bill that passed that did not have this provision in it. The Senate bill is still in Senator Green's committee,
okay,
and can be acted upon, or we could introduce a new bill, or you guys could introduce a bill. We can talk about the strategy as how you want to get through, but we've already endorsed this proposal.
Okay. Does the current language, I don't even know what the current language says, does it need to be changed? Does it need to be amendments to what we have before us?
Well, possibly. There are a couple different, if you remember, there are a couple different alternatives we talked about addressing this. One is getting rid of the cap. Another one was just having the cap apply to a higher number. I think that was Representative Dyson's suggestion. And I think there was a third one I can't really remember. But as it sits right now, it's a very simple amendment. It just simply says the 20% cap is repealed. It's basically a one-liner.
Since that is a federal requirement, how do you repeal a federal requirement?
The federal requirement essentially applies to the federal money. And it doesn't, and the states, although they are required to spend a certain amount of state money participating in this program, there's a more liberal interpretation as to how this state can spend the money. So, in other words, you'd be using your state share of the money to provide benefits for families that go over the 20% cap that's in federal law. And this is well tested. Many other states are doing this.
Yeah, well, just to follow up, I understand that we don't have to comply with the law if we want to pay the full cost, 100%. But if we want federal participation on the money that's paid to those families that qualify, we're only going to get federal participation for those families that qualify under the federal law,
right? Essentially, what you're doing is you're setting up for if you reach your 20% threshold and you're over the federal limit and you still want to be able to provide benefits beyond that 20%, you're essentially setting up a separate state program that looks right. Identical to the TANF program or ATAP, but you're to be able to provide the benefits with state money.
It's 100% state money.
That's true. What you can do, though, is it sort of comes out in the wash because then you're providing a greater share of federal money to the folks that are not over the limit.
You'll have to explain the detail of that to some other
state. Maybe Sandy could explain how that's done in other states. You might have some more
time. I'm going to take just a 30-second break, and if we could get the mics off, I need to talk to Mr. Norman for just half a shake.
Yes, I do. And Jim is correct. It's really a bookkeeping issue because you can use your state MOE, which is already committed to the program. You've got a certain amount of MOE that you've got to have, maintenance of effort, that has to be there in order to get the TANF block grant, the federal money. And so it's really a matter of bookkeeping. You shift more of the federal dollar to all of those families that are under the time limit and use more of your state MOE on what states call a state-only program. So it's really just a bookkeeping issue. It should not cost you any additional state dollars to do this.
Sandy, with the maintenance of effort discussion, and if you predict out year after year after year, is there a time when the maintenance of effort does not pay enough? There's something about maintenance of effort, I don't understand, but is there sort of a time when it can close or does not continue to do what it's supposed to do?
Well, I mean, I think a number of states don't agree that they should have to maintain such a high maintenance of effort. Is that what you're referring to?
Not necessarily. I'm just wondering if this only works for 2 or 3 or 4 years, and then after that, you start to fade off in the maintenance effort. Is it always the same thing you have to come back every year? Is it a dollar for dollar for what you spent the previous year?
Maybe I could. The federal law says that states have got to spend at least 80% of the amount of money that they spent in 1994 when they were running the AFDC program. The federal block grant is based upon, for the current 5-year or 6-year authorization period that we're in, the federal block grant is basically the amount of money that the federal government spent
on the AFDC program in 1994. The law says that states have to spend at least 80% of the money that they spent, or 75% if you're making all the required work participation rates, or 75%. You have to spend 80 or 75% of the money that we spent in '94. It is a strict number.
And you can always calculate that number.
Yes.
There's nothing to do then with what happened last year.
No.
Okay. This is a different.
Okay. Very good. Cool. And you need to also recognize that 2003, the TANF program will be reauthorized, and so that whole issue will come up during reauthorization, and at the very least, they're going to, you know, draw a different line. They're probably not going to hold states to 1994 levels. That will shift in 2003.
Is it 84 or 94?
94.
Basically, what you're saying is that under that federal law, no state was able to achieve a savings greater than 25% of 94 base, because the state still had to continue to spend 75% of the total amount being spent in 94 for those same kind of services. Is that why some states have now branched out and are utilizing some of those funds as opposed to welfare payments? They're now showing up in the form of educational grants and opportunities for welfare to work programs and that kind of stuff. Is that what's happening in those other states?
Essentially, yes, Senator. Although what there are strict limits on what you can spend TANF dollars for in your required MOE. But in some cases, states have ventured out and gone beyond what has traditionally been the AFDC program. For instance, in Alaska, one of the ways we are able to achieve general fund savings is by taking the federal TANF dollars that come to us. The whole program has been quite a bit of savings because we're not paying as much in benefit dollars as we used to. So we've taken that savings and we have replaced, in the Department of Education, general fund dollars that used to fund child care. So now that's almost 100% of federally funded program. The savings, the general fund savings we've taken out of child care, are a savings to the general fund in the state.
No,
but you can't you know, build bridges and do all kinds of odd things. Right. It has to be related to the TANF purposes.
Up until 93, when they redraw the law, hopefully come up with a different number.
2003, yeah, and it's we don't know exactly what that law is going to look like right now.
Are the things we need to do to prepare for 2003 statutory language? Or is it the agenda? Or do we just say this is the best we can do for 2003 until the reauthorization, and then we have to revisit it?
Well, Senator, I think the best thing we can do is advocate on a political level with our congressional delegation and others in Congress. What most states are saying are that they're taking the position that, you know, please do not cut our federal funding for these programs, because even though the amount of money for the benefits for the TANF program have gone down, what states are doing, as we have done, as we just talked about, are using those funds to help make general fund savings in other places. So if there's a reduction to the state block grant to our state, that will have repercussions across many programs that are essentially TANF funded. So we're asking for a couple things: that we keep the level of funding at least the same as it's been in the past. And that's a hard argument to make, because Congress is saying, well, the caseload has gone down, you certainly don't need as much money. Well, the money is being used for a different purpose. And so if the block grant is cut, we will suffer. The second big thing that states are asking for is to continue to have the flexibility that has been afforded states under welfare reform. I think one of the reasons you've seen welfare reform be so successful across the entire nation is that states have been freed from the shackles of federal rules and being allowed to run programs that they see best fit for their state. And we've seen success in Alaska because of that flexibility, and we've seen success all across the nation because of that flexibility. So those are the kind of the two big things that we're advocating for with Congress right now.
Okay, I'm going to make a request, and this may be a little premature about have some people here in the room, and I felt that everyone in the room understands. Thank you.
Is anyone in the world?
Okay, and for that reason, is there out there a primer for people? This is what happened under ATAP. This is what happened under TANF. And sort of a timeline, and then if you do this, this money can be used for this. This money can be used for this. And it is not necessarily that we're saving, quote, dollars. They're being rerouted, so to speak. And, but it can't be used for, this can't be used for childcare. This can be used for childcare. Do you have that model or anything like that out there that could make it a lot easier to understand? And going back, see, because every time I have this discussion, I have to go back to the 80% or the 94% and the 75%, and then I have to re-understand it all the time. And we kind of need a guide. Is that possible?
There might be something like that, Senator, although the thing, there has, this has sort of been an innovation on the federal level to allow states to have a great deal of flexibility in how they can best serve, you know, poor families.
Just so when we are in the process of redoing our legislation, what is the background information we need to know and the flexibility we created? Just give us a reminder on it. Sandy, is that out of the box or unnecessary or what?
Well, no, I think the department could develop something specific to Alaska about where this. I think, Jim, if I'm understanding the senator, she's wanting to know where the dollars have gone. Since the block grant, where both the state and the federal dollars have gone, and where the state flexibility points are. Is that correct, Senator?
That's correct. And then I want to know, if we do this, this happens. If we don't do this, this happens. So that in explaining to other people who are not here and who do not spend a lot of time learning this or understanding it, it's easier for me to explain and for Senator to learn. Because I'm going to forget a lot of this next time it's time for me to come back to someone. And I just need sort of maybe we talk about it some more. We'll get there.
If I may. Excuse me, I think you're on exactly the right course here. Probably most of those discussions will happen when you're hearing these bills.
Right.
You know, and so on and so forth. I am so engaged in what we're talking about here, that I'm really hoping that we can get down through each of these here and categorize the ones on which the department agrees, mm-hmm. and a game plan for getting those done, and sort out the ones we don't that we can fight over, you know, in many months and so on. And I'm hoping, Jim, Mr. Norman, that you can very clearly. Also, I mean, I think we owe it to ourselves to say to you, particularly on the ones that are policy decisions and practice, you know, are you going to get after these, you know, and how can we hold you accountable and so on? And I guess I would encourage us to not get too bogged down in the details of each of these here, if we can.
But I do think that coming up with the explanation for the whole thing, we need to be able to say, this is the background, this is what we did, this is what we had the opportunity to do. If we do this, this happens. If we don't, this happens. And that would generally be for everything on the recommendation.
Just so you know, we'd be glad to try to answer that question. I did prepare a handout for you to show where we were the year before welfare reform took place in terms of how we were spending the money and where we are now. And you know, if you, I don't know if you want to get into this now, I can leave it with you. You can talk about it later, or you can talk about it during the session. But it's a kind of a colorful explanation.
Wonderful.
It's like where we are. Yeah. I noted that. Sandy had made basically two recommendations under her first recommendation. First, that she tried to avoid the 20% cap. Second, she said it made no sense to jeopardize the TANF money, which we could lose as much as 5% of it by a miscalculation in that 20%. And therefore, she recommended that the statute be amended to permit you to use narrow criteria to extend some benefits. that said she believed that DPA needs to make extraordinary efforts to ensure that as few families as possible reach the 60-month limit, and went on to say there does not appear to be any formal process in place yet to provide such additional assistance in staffing for mental health, alcohol, or substance abuse, and so on, and then recommends on the next page an additional statutory change, and that is that Alaska may want to consider creating this separate group. And you were talking about, I thought, the separate, I thought the first aspect only, as far as the law being before the senator's committee at this time. Is that second aspect that Sandy has recommended also within the law that's currently before the committee, or does that take another amendment?
That's a very good question. It's actually something we're trying to figure out, whether we actually have to create some sort of a statutory authority for a separate state program or not. We're not clear on that, and we're talking with our attorney general's office to figure that out.
But you are working on that because I assume you want to support such a program so as to avoid the penalties.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. And you'll get back to the committee on that?
We sure will.
Go ahead. Sandy, second item?
Okay, the second recommendation is to develop a progressive sanction system which resulted in full family sanction. Currently, your sanction policy, and this is sanctions for people who are not cooperating with the program, is to remove what you call the adult needs from the grant, which is about a 40% grant reduction, which is hefty. And it for the first sanction, there's no penalty if somebody starts cooperating. The second sanction lasts for 6 months, even if the person wants to cooperate. And the third and subsequent sanctions are for 12 months, regardless of if the individual wants to cooperate. 37 other states, and Oregon was one of those, took a different strategy, and one that I think is far more preferable for a number of reasons. These states have done staged sanctions where, and I'll just use Oregon for an example. It's a three-step process. First sanction is a very small grant reduction of $50. The second sanction is the adult needs. And the third sanction can result in the full closure of that grant. However, for any of those sanctions, it could be cured with cooperation. So there's no prolonged penalty, which I think works. Those prolonged penalties work as a disincentive to get people back engaged in cooperating, which is what you really want to have happen. The other thing for the family that happens is, while those individuals are on those prolonged sanctions, the time clock continues to tick. And so it really disadvantages the family as a whole. It's a much cleaner and straightforward approach if somebody just does not want to cooperate, to eventually go ahead and close the grant to the point at which they do want to cooperate. You can reopen, and the family still has some time to be able to move themselves forward. So we've also found in the research that many of the advocates advocate against full family sanctions, saying it will raise sanction rates, that you will be knocking lots of people off of welfare, and children will suffer. Well, in fact, in virtually every one of the states that has gone to full family sanction rates have been reduced. Because, again, there's a great deal of incentive to go ahead and get back in the program and cooperate and start to move your family home. So we're recommending that you take a look at that, and that you may well want to go to a progressive full family sanction policy.
Senator, this is something that we're looking at. I think that our sanction policies in the state in some ways haven't really worked very well. Particularly the biggest issue is because somebody who gets a sanction and then immediately figures out that they need to comply may not be eligible for benefits again for 6 months later. So if you're looking at this from a behavioral standpoint, there's the reward for compliance is so delayed that it doesn't actually bring about compliance as well as it could. So The ability to immediately cure is an important one, and I think it's certainly worthy of consideration of going towards a full family sanction, although we haven't made a decision yet as a department whether or not we want to do that, but we look forward to having discussions with the legislature about that.
You don't think you'll have your view on that before a session? You're going to wait for a table discussion?
We could. I think that it'll presumably, it would be my thought that this would be an interactive discussion we'd have with the legislature. There are different ways of putting these sanction regimes out, and states use those kinds of things. We'd be looking forward to talking with Sandy, for instance, who's got some experience with this and knowing how other states do it.
I agree with that, because when we originally had the discussion on that, we were looking for ways to modify behavior. We kind of came back with the final hammer on the first go-round, and so it might not be
I might add one thing, though. As you go towards a full family, if you went towards a full family sanction, we would want to make absolutely sure that there wasn't a mistake, that the family was actually in compliance and they weren't. So there would be certain levels of further scrutiny and review before we ever, sort of drop the full hammer on the family, so to speak. But I know that's one of the major concerns of folks in our department. So
but there are some models out there to look at and compare to see if they're their successes.
Right.
So
other states
the next one?
Yeah, the next one we actually covered discussion about the separate state program. So I think that's been covered.
Okay. Did you want to respond?
Yes, we're certainly looking at it. As I mentioned to Senator Taylor, I think we have to figure out how we're going to do that.
Okay, Sandy, on the next one.
Okay, the next one is to strengthen the diversion program. And by diversion program, this is an upfront process that actually what you're trying to do is to get people employed before they come on to cash assistance. And right now, what's in state law, and this is just an optional piece for applicants. They don't have to take advantage of this, but they could get as much as 2 months of assistance, I believe, in exchange for not coming on full cash assistance. In our interviews across the state, we found that this was utilized very, very little. And the reason that was repeatedly stated was that really wasn't a sufficient amount of money to be able to get people up and going and into a more self-sufficient situation, so very few clients took advantage of it. We believe this whole area of diversion probably needs a much closer look, and at least need to be considering 3 months probably cash assistance in order to really incent people to utilize it. I also think there's a great deal of room to look at just the whole process of engaging applicants when they come through the door and the kind of requirements that might be placed upon them in the applicant stage, for instance, work search requirements, that kind of thing, so that immediately people come through the front door, they know that this whole process is about becoming employed versus just becoming eligible for benefits. So I think there's a great deal of room to probably improve that upfront process. And in fact, if you have a very strong upfront diversion process, it should actually save the state money because effective programs across the nation are able to divert fairly significant percentages of applicants into employment so that you don't have those prolonged cash assistance payments going out. So this whole area, I think, deserves a pretty close look.
We think it's a very good recommendation in the report. Both the statutory change is something I think that we would support in 3 months. I think that the statutory change, though, is really in some ways the simplest. Really, what it needs to be is operationalized in a different way. Some of those valid, I think, suggestions in the report really are about how we operate sort of the upfront part of our program. There's a criticism, I think it's a valid one. There's too much of an eligibility focus instead of a self-sufficiency focus, just in that it's not being sort of intentional. It was carried over from the previous AFDC program. We want to sort of turn that around and making more use of diversion is one of the key aspects of changing that around that upfront process.
Yeah, so you really got to change the culture, the mindset of the staff that on that. And I don't see how we can do anything to help you on that except be bad cops threatening you with something. We might be thinking about how can we change the measures of mission stuff to remind us both. That's such a clumsy tool.
Yeah, I think we've done a pretty good, really good job actually of bringing the agency around in terms of changing the culture and the mindset. But I think what we're talking about here is strictly the process. See, the folks could be very inclined towards wanting to help people towards employment, but if we're saying this is the first step you have to do and this is the second step you have to do, and it has an eligibility focus, then even though they have the right attitude, they're forced to run it through that paperwork and that process. And we're going to take a good look at changing that around.
But you don't need us, our help, to change that, do you?
Representative. When you move into this section of the report that's in management priorities, and I can tell you right now that almost every one of those we think is a good recommendation, and they're all things that we are committed to doing just in terms of changing the operations of the agency to achieve these recommendations. So. There is, and I think that's why Sandy categorized them under management. There really is nothing. There's no legislation needed. And to be honest with you, I'd be glad to do this. We're not even asking for any more money to do this. This is strictly just an operational issue.
Yeah, and several things that have made this kind of work pretty good. Certainly, Sandy's credentials and immense experience in Oregon, and the confidence that Kara Perdue had in her. Perhaps Senator Taylor's classmate being involved and so on and so forth. But indeed, because they have put this under the legislative priorities, it makes me think that there's a role for us to set to help focus your attention on putting people to work is the highest priority as opposed to getting them qualified for entitlements.
I think it's like the number of months, too.
That's a pretty simple change to the statute.
Then it puts you in a position, though, or the department into a position that the focus is in carrying out under the management priorities much more clearly. But that if we give it a boost by the first thing.
That's true.
Okay. The next one, Sandy.
Okay, the final one under legislative priorities is to authorize a more complete wage subsidy. And this is something that we discussed both with Representative Dyson and Senator Green when we were in Alaska last spring. Oregon has a very successful private sector wage subsidy program, which takes the cash grant, the food stamp benefits, and cashes both of those out to use as reimbursement to private sector employers who are willing to work with our TANF recipients and provide them actual training opportunities on the job site for up to 6 months. This has been a very successful tool to get people engaged in the private sector, as well as we found, and especially in our more rural parts of Oregon, we found it to be actually an economic development tool as well, because it allows small employers, which are predominantly what we have in rural Oregon, to be able to expand their or explore expansion of their business when they otherwise wouldn't have sufficient capital to do so. And we found that this has worked time and time again with these small employers, where they will take one of our participants, put them in this training opportunity, and give them a chance to test the waters about are they going to be able to expand their business enough. They discover, yes, indeed they can, and quite often pick up that participant as a full-time, unsubsidized employee. We've also found that it actually works well with our harder-to-serve clients because we shaped it that way, because this isn't a very subsidized approach. So we purposely put our more barrier-prone high intensity opportunity. So when you pencil it out, it actually becomes a very cost effective tool for the state to get people employed and becomes a good economic development tool for the employer. It's very popular among our small employers in Oregon and has proven to be quite successful. And in our exploration in Alaska, we asked in many communities if they thought that this would be something that would work, and had a great deal of positive response. The current sort of OJT approaches or trial by hire in many areas, the staff or the local community people felt that it was not a sufficient incentive, and they did not believe that they'd get a lot of employers involved. But both those approaches are new, I want to be real clear. So there is no track record to know how well they've been working, but I think this is an area you might want to explore more thoroughly to see if there is a more expansive approach.
Yes, Senator, we definitely think this is a good recommendation. We want to look at it. Particularly the Institute has a great deal of experience. I think this is how the Institute really first got into the business of being concerned about welfare reforms, better ways of getting private sector employers involved. And so we look forward to their expertise in this regard. I do have a question, though, and we'll get into this, but I don't know how much we actually need to change our statute in this regard. I think most of it's actually just maybe policy-driven, but we have to take a little bit better look at that.
Thank you. That's surprising to me. It takes food stamps and TANF funds instead of giving that to recipients, you're going to give it to an employer. I think that's radical change. I'm surprised that you have the flexibility to do that, given there's federal funds there. So it's about your expertise. I'm really impressed. But it seems to me that this is such a radical change in our orientation in dealing with indigent people that if anything is going to work, it needs to rise almost to the level of a crusade. You know, that somebody that really has a vision for putting people to work as opposed to on the welfare rolls, you know, has got to have just a passion for this philosophically in order to utterly change the direction that we're going here. And first of all, if you and the Knowles administration agree, you know, it's a whale of a culture change in how to deal with, you know, folks that are needy. And I just can't see it ever working as something you kind of work at incrementally. And oh, by the way, if you have a chance, do this. So I'm struggling here, but I want to get from where we're at to something that really works. If this is as valid a concept as Sandy and Oregon seem to think.
Representative, I think it's a very valid concept. Let me say one of the reasons we haven't employed this to the extent that we probably could is because, well, frankly, we've been very successful with getting people to work. I mean, our caseload has gone down 40%, over 40% now. And one of the reasons for that, frankly, is that the economy has been really good. Well, now two factors are coming into play. The folks who are easiest to get employed are probably already there. And secondly, the economy is starting to turn around. So looking at creating really greater incentives for employers to help to put people in a workplace setting is something that I think we need to entertain more seriously at this juncture of the program. So it's a very good suggestion we'll be looking at.
I couldn't help but write down the word audit, success, abuse,
or
conduct. And that's the management of that program, I think it's aggressive leader as well. So, like that. Okay, if you move on into policy priorities.
Okay.
Can we just clarify before we pass off on that? Jim was indicating he didn't think that legislative action would be necessary. And of course, Fred commented on that. They've got this down under legislative priorities as something that we may need to make change on.
change is needed, you will make that recommendation also?
Yes, we will. It just that when we, the first, actually Senator Green's bill passed several years ago, there's a pretty broad language under what's called work supplementation. I think that gives us the statutory authority to run this program the way it's envisioned. But if not, certainly if not, we will support the statutory provisions that will make it more effective.
And if I may, I would think, Senator Taylor, that we probably need to revisit the mission statement and some measures to reflect the areas that we agree on here.
Okay, Sandy was going into policy priorities. You may be able to scoot through these a little more quickly.
The first one is change the child care co-pay schedule to eliminate what I call cliff. And I understand that that the department as well as the Department of Education, they're both working on this, so Jim can probably comment on it some more. But what happens now in your child care co-pay schedule is it goes up in stair steps, similar to the tax code. So a very small increase in income can create a rather large increase in the copay. And so you do have situations where someone can get a raise, but they're actually taking home less money because they're having to pay out a disproportionately larger share in daycare. And we went through the very same issue in Oregon. And so this is just a recommendation to take those cliffs out so that you really can incent people as they move up the economic continuum there so that truly when they get a raise, it is a raise. And I, like I said, I believe they're already working on this issue. So maybe Jim wants to comment on this.
Yes, Senator. I'd like to point out that the deputy Commissioner Yvonne Chase from the Department of Education. So you might want to ask her about this, but I can say briefly that we had a briefing from folks education just last week, and they're definitely working on this. And it is a regulatory change that's required.
And I think we have to at some point get back to the point there is there will eventually, hopefully, be some point where a person can qualify for any grants. Just wherever you could just come down here and be closer to that or to this right. That's the whole thing where they're so successful. Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Yvonne Chase, I'm Deputy Commissioner for Department of Education and Early Development. And Sandy was absolutely correct in terms of her description of what happens with the cliff effect. And this is something that many states have grappled with. Oregon, I think, to their credit, is one of the states that was able to move to eliminate those cliffs fairly quickly. We do, as Jim said, we've had a working group. I think we're going to be able to eliminate the cliffs, the cliff effect in Alaska by next July. We have a couple of challenges in eliminating that cliff effect. And one is that we have some legislative intent in terms of cost neutrality. So we've been trying to make sure as we did our calculations that we can accomplish this for the individuals who are at the lowest income and the most in need in terms of child care subsidy and also maintain that cost neutrality. I think that we have figured out a system to accomplish that, and we'll be taking some initial steps actually this month and next month, as well as taking regulations to the state board the end of this month to open for public comment. And we hope that they will adopt those in their March meeting and we would be able to implement by July. What this does, and again, Sandy characterized it very accurately, if someone gets a 50 cent per hour increase, they might be just at the top of the lowest income bracket where, in fact, they're paying 3% of their child care costs and the state's paying 97%. That 50 cents an hour may push them to paying 15%. Of their child care costs. So now they've actually lost money in the long run and they're further behind. What Oregon did and other states are beginning to follow because they realize how devastating this cliff effect is to parents, And that sometimes those parents and the children in childcare literally disappear from the system. And we're not sure where they are, what kind of situations they're in. But to begin to have a system where when they move from public assistance and pass one, where they might have had some initial childcare for training or for other things that they needed while they were still an active recipient, that they can move to pass two with a zero copay. So they have a couple months to kind of get on their feet. And then the scale ends up being a sliding scale with a curve as opposed to this cliff effect. And at the same time, we needed to look at the top end of the scale and make some determinations in terms of the highest income that you can have and at what point, as you said, those individuals move on. We'll be providing the committee some more information, but just as an aside, we've taken some communities to try to do an intensive look at them, and the local administrator for child care in Wasilla Palmer area has actually worked with us to do a fairly broad overview of that caseload. What we've seen is that public assistance clients have done very well as they have moved through that system. Both from the efforts of public assistance in terms of the case management, and then through the child care system to actually need less subsidy as they increased in wages.
And I assume at some point there you would maybe decline a salary increase is the wrong word, but you would just not accept it. And so you stay at the lower level and the higher participation by the state, so you don't ever allow the dog. So I see that. I think that's great. But that does not, again, does not require legislation. That's internal, just reworking the sliding fee, the transition first into the sliding fee, and then examine the top end.
Correct. Yes, Senator, there are some regulation changes.
Regulatory changes.
Sure.
You need us?
Just your overwhelming support.
my goodness, yes.
Yeah, thank you. This is a crusade I'm on it, but you know the whatever the pieces of paper and tracking thing that has to happen to qualify a person for benefits and the job training and so on and so forth. It's my desire certainly that that same piece of paper or same bits of information would be sufficient for you all to qualify these people for the various levels. Of, and I'm sure hoping you might need a little bit more information, but. That the person doesn't have to go on a pilgrimage from department to department to deal with it, and that you'd be able to transmit that information seamlessly electronically, and that the person would end up not having to have, quote, a separate caseworker, you know, in the assistance and in DEED. And so, you know, I'll be a nag about that, and I don't want to harass you, but, you know, it just seems very important that. We streamline the process for the recipients. As you know better than I do, some of those folks have limited capacity to deal with all of the administrative things that we.
I think it can be said without not being correct, but you're here with people. So we need to establish that. I think that's going to be a priority in the upcoming year or so, that we figure out how to do the seamless representation and a client. With a caseworker that works through several different agencies, departments, and I mean between departments as well, and this type of case management. I don't think that sounds particularly radical at all. It seems like it'd be a lot simpler. Unfortunately, the only problem being a major personality conflict, you know, with some client and an employee. Mm-hmm. And then how do we work through that? Do you shift them and then match or something, you know, but whereas now they've worked with someone for so long time, moving to the next, then they have a new person, they say, oh, yes, I don't have to worry about her or him now. I'm into it again. So I think that would be the bigger thing is the match between the client and the person they see. But I think those comments do need to be addressed throughout and be thinking about how we implement something where we don't have people going from this building to the next building and the anchors back out here or whatever. Makes sense to me.
If I might just briefly comment about that, because actually it's a not a harassment complaint. It really is something that we need to look at in terms of clients. And I think that, as Jim said, we've been involved in a number of meetings. I think we have a solution to that that will not only make it seamless for the client, but will drastically reduce, if not eliminate, that necessity for them to appear in person. Mm-hmm. Oh. We need to be able to use technology effectively for them as well. So,
you want it for providers?
It's for the client as they move, the parent actually, as they move from being a client with public assistance to towards self-sufficiency and then still need child care, they move into a different child care system, but we should be able to do something, and we think we have figured out how to do it across agencies so that the client really doesn't see much of that movement. They're able to continue their subsidy.
Mm-hmm. Lest you get too comfortable, I'm so radical that I want to stir DFYS and public safety corrections into that. So if the family you're working with has an open DFYS case, you know, that maybe one person be working with them, and if there's a low-level probation parole supervision that needs to go on, you know, that we can still work towards perhaps a single point of contact for that client.
You do know there's a group building out here.
Yeah. Well, you always have been our leaders.
Okay, that's right. They're excited about it. There's a lot of the people who create problems. Our problem leaders and other than you as well. And let's get them all at the same table and say, you can't play this one against this one. And we eliminate a lot of stuff. All right. Next one, Sandy.
Okay. The next one is to revise the policy and practices for treating individuals limited by incapacity from full participation in work activities and require mental health and substance abuse treatment when needed. I believe the agency is working on changing this policy. Currently, and it may have just been an oversight or a little loophole, currently the way the regulations read, if a doctor says somebody is incapacitated, then they get an exemption from full participation in the program. We're recommending that exemption be to the level of the incapacity, so that if somebody still can do part-time involvement, they should still be required to do so and should still be enter into a plan. And then for those that do have mental health or drug and alcohol issues, they need to be mandated into treatment as part of that plan.
Any comment? Just that we have it's a good suggestion of rate change and policy change in progress.
I think we contract some of this originally. And met with some musicians. So the same thing about singing with your future kids at school. You know, it needs to be part of that whole. It's okay. Next one, Sandy?
On that one.
Okay, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
This one basically talks about an exemption that is currently provided if you are a substance abuser. That exempts you from having to comply, and thus you continue to receive, and because the 60-month clock is not running on you. That has to be one of the most backward policies I've ever heard of. Why in the world, if somebody's an alcoholic, would you then use that as an excuse for them to continue to sit on welfare to be an alcoholic so that we can continue to buy booze for them forever?
Yeah, I think one of the confusions around this when we drafted the original law, or at least the reg, was that we were saying that we're not going to require them to participate in the work activity, probably because they wouldn't be a very good employee. What we didn't say is that, but you do have to participate in a treatment program.
Right.
And so that's what we want to be able to do as a requirement for receiving the benefit.
And that, then you are making those regulatory changes as we speak.
Yes, we are.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you.
Next one, Cindy.
Next one relates, and this is for clients who are claiming a disability. They should be required to file for federal disability benefits. There is a federal program called the SSI program, Supplemental Security. Security Income Program is totally federal money, and if in fact they're that disabled that they can't participate, they should be at least required to file for those benefits. And I believe the agency is changing that policy as well.
Yeah, yes, we are changing that policy as well. I will say, though, we've had a pretty good record of this just voluntarily because the SSI benefits are not time limited and are actually a little bit more generous than the ATAP benefits. So a lot of people have been doing so voluntarily, but we want to put it in place so that it's basically required. Mm-hmm.
But it's just maybe a requirement.
It is. Right.
And you're going to require them to do that and then hold as the hammer? The fact that you will cut off their payments if they don't? Is that what we're doing?
It would probably be an element of their family self-sufficiency plan. And so anybody who doesn't comply with their family self-sufficiency plan can get sanctioned. We wouldn't want to make sure they didn't fall through the cracks because these are truly the neediest of clients.
Well, sure.
If they have problems with the application process or whatever, we want to make sure that that's done.
But what worries me is that we just pay lip service to this by talking about it here, saying that we're going to insist that they go do this, and as the chairman just pointed out, we've all had, I think, some level of personal experience with this. SSI is a very difficult program to get into. Yes, it is generous, but the feds are very reluctant to add people to that program, and as a consequence, they deny an awful lot of applications and force them through appeals and so on. So it's one thing to say we're going to do it, but just saying that, knowing full well that probably 65-70% of the people who make application are going to be denied, that may not provide any significant help either to them or to us in the program.
If they still qualify for state programs, because of the fact that they've been denied SSI, would not disqualify them for state benefits.
No, presumably, if they're going through a determination process, and the senator's correct, and many of them are denied at first. A lot of them, based on appeal, though, go back and actually get approved. But there's an interim time there, in which they would continue, in this case, to receive the ATAP benefit. We just want to make sure that they're going through the application process for SSI. If they get denied on an interim basis or just they get flat denied in the end, then they'll continue to receive ATAP.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead,
Sam.
Okay, the last one is to reduce the 12-month exemption period for parents of infants to 16 weeks. 16 weeks is your parental leave law in Alaska, so that's what regular-looking parents are able to take. Off of work, and it seems to be inconsistent that the folks on ATAP are not required to do anything for 12 months. Most states have reduced it down to their parental leave law, so we recommend that the same be done here.
And we are pursuing this in regulation as well, though I might, especially since Yvonne is sitting here, I might add that there is an increased need for child care, particularly infant child care, which is not easily available. So Yvonne, you might want to say a couple things about that side of the coin, but that's one of the considerations.
If I might just briefly, I think one of the other things that Sandy commented on later in the recommendations was the fact that the difficulty of finding both infant care as well as what we call non-traditional hours, parents that work swing shifts at different places, and evening care. And so as Jim said, this is something that we're going to need to try to, frankly, provide some incentives for providers to take infants. And infants are a group that require a lot of care, and so you can't take as many.
We are very active in the MATSU, let me tell you. We've got people on every committee out there working independently and with agencies. So, no, and then you start to get into the, you strengthen your regs and your regulations and your licensing, and then you end up saying, well, we don't have enough providers. Because they don't qualify for the licensing, the permitting, and all the requirements. And so, I mean, you're in a dilemma. because it's when you're involved in safety of children, you know, good kids, and then how do we target? And otherwise, you have, providers who don't work through you and going under the radar, and, which is the best. Modifying the regs, conditional regs or whatever, to attract people. This is not a discussion about, but it's certainly a biggie.
Yes, and just briefly, it is a biggie. Although the regulations that we put in place so far, like you said, really focused at the health and safety of children in those facilities. I think that most of the providers who were not licensed before actually have the ability to be licensed fairly easily, and we are also reducing what has been a fairly enormous amount of paperwork.
I know that was a major issue.
We're saving the trees. Yes, sir.
Well, I just think that this is a very critical tool, and if it's not in place, all of the push to get somebody off welfare and to work, if that waitress can't show up and work that evening shift, she doesn't have a job. And that may be where the best tips are and the best opportunity for her to earn a living for herself and her family. But if she can't find a place to place her young child or children, there's absolutely no way she can take that job. She doesn't have mom or grandma or somebody else to push the kids off on while she goes to work. And that's why I have been very concerned about current policy. I'm actually losing daycare in my district right now because of current policy. And I'm going, why in the world? When these people are successful, they've been doing a good job, they get audited, your people come in and the rest of it, and now they can handle fewer kids because of policies implemented by the department. And yet, here we are looking at trying to get these folks into some sort of meaningful and worthwhile, fulfilling kind of lifestyle. And the very department that is causing the results that I'm seeing in my district of fewer children being placed within a daycare says that one of their policies is going to be to enhance and increase daycare facilities. It sounds like we're going in opposite directions internally within the department.
May I comment just briefly? And I'd be glad to meet with the senator and go over the specifics in terms of your district, because that's important for us to look at. But there were some slight modifications to the staffing ratios. We did go back, however, and make some adjustments. So I think that the final regulations that passed did not have those numbers that perhaps you were concerned about. The other thing that we did, frankly, was to give some incentives and increases for, one, for infants and toddlers, providers that care for them, and also for providers that are licensed, as some kind of encouragement to move those individuals from registered care to licensed care and keep it positive.
This is sort of a side question, but it's probably something we should be thinking about. In the new organization of your department, in the Department of Education, and it be under the state's rule, is that going to work? I mean, I don't want you to go out on the fence on it. That's not what I'm thinking. But do we need to modify or change or mold something a little different for the child care piece, since it is not K through 12 plus university, emphasis? Is there a different segment, or are you working through that in the department? Or?
Again, just briefly, Senator, I think that I think that we are working through that in the department. We're looking at education from the entire perspective of, from the cradle to the grave, as they say. And part of what we're looking at in early childhood programs, whether it's child care or Head Start or other programs, is school readiness. And it's also a safe and healthy environment for children. Any place a program is going to require coordination with other departments. And
I'm very concerned, though, because we know that the emphasis in the state board is not infant child care. I mean, that's not their case, that's not their charge. It's traditionally been in the school, and how do school districts do, and how does the Department of Education interact with school districts? It's not individual caregivers.
I just want to be sure we don't get carried away. And, but I don't want schools for babies. No. And when we have government go into that, or even that much more, that's not what we're about. That's not what we're talking about today, so we'll have this conversation in no time.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. But, Sandy, next one, management priorities. By the way, we've got about 15 more minutes, so we need to move.
Okay.
All right.
Develop and implement an in-depth and intensive services for families reaching the time limits. We touched on that earlier when we talked about the time clock ticking. Jim, you want to comment?
Yes. We actually are in the process right now of doing intensive work of what we're calling staffing. So, as you're well aware, there are first families that are going to be hitting the 60-month limit are going to be doing so. July of next year, and so what we have established is what we're calling extension review staffing. It's going to involve the case manager for the client, the eligibility technician for the client, and social worker, another individual in the staffing. They're going to sit down and look at all the circumstances surrounding these families and determine a couple things. Number one, what kind of services they might need to continue on the path to self-sufficiency, and second, to determine whether or not they are going to be eligible for an extension of benefits based on the criteria. So what Sandy's suggestion is here is really in progress, and we're actually just testing it out now, last month and this month, on some early families. We're going to be doing something like 500 staffings for families that are going to be reaching time in the next 3 months. So it's from an agency perspective, it's a huge undertaking that we're doing. But it's essential because these folks are reaching a time limit, and we need to make decisions on whether or not they get extended benefits or not.
I have some real questions about what the current status is, because I think we in the legislature, at least I certainly am ignorant of what the current status is. And I guess my question would kind of go like this. Is there a geographic factor where if you live geographically within a given area of the state, none of these laws apply to you? You just automatically assume that you don't have to work, you don't have to find work, because there just, quote, isn't any work out there. And they've all somehow, quote, decided there shall never be any work in that area. So as a consequence, none of these laws apply. And then somebody else within the department has made another decision geographically that says, oh, geographically, they've always had work in that area. Now maybe they don't have any work. So all those people need to move and go find work, and we'll give them training so they can move to Albuquerque. But you see, that's exactly what's happening in my district, in my communities, but in other districts where my colleagues and I have a chance to look. Nobody seems to be going off the welfare. Nobody's going to get hit by the 60-month limit because somebody made a decision. And I don't know if that's racially based. I don't know if it's geographically based. I don't know if it's based on somebody's conclusion about what the economies have always traditionally been, so they must always continue that way. I don't know how those decisions are working. But I get the feeling that the only people going to be cut off of welfare are folks sitting in places like Wrangell, Petersburg, Ketchikan, and maybe a few over in Sitka, and that I ain't going to see a whole lot of people out in the villages cut off of any welfare. They're going to still be sitting out there living off of the same welfare payment that they've been living off of now for maybe three generations in that area. So I want to talk about reality, not just what would be kind of nice. So maybe you can answer those questions.
Sure. Senator, I think the geographical distinction that you're referring to is in federal law. And it says that for reservations, Indian reservations and Alaska Native villages with unemployment rates, effective unemployment rates, over 50%, the families living in those villages, be they Native or not, are exempt from the 5-year limit. That is in federal law. It's not. It was not a state decision that was made to do that. I want to clarify though that even though they are may be exempt from the 5-year limit, they all are. They are still required, and as we were required in Alaska, for them to pursue self-sufficiency activities. Now, if there's not a job in the village, as we are well aware, the point out these are limited in rural Alaska. There is an expectation that they at least do something in exchange for their benefit, which might basically be some sort of community work experience or that kind of thing. So I have to admit that there's sort of limited effectiveness in how well we apply that policy, but that is the policy. So, but to clarify, that is a federal, it's in the federal welfare law that creates a geographic exemption for
How do you get classified as a native village? Because obviously that's what I need for my district. I don't need any of this stuff. I just need classified as a native village.
I believe it's the villages that are listed under ANSA as a Alaska Native Village.
You're kidding me. So the disproportionate aspects of ANSA, where literally villages were left landless and with no village status because of what I believe was totally corrupt politics played on the passage of land claims, where my people end up landless, and other people down the road who didn't even qualify for a village, places like Ruby as a perfect example, which was a white mining community and had never been a native village, they qualify for village status. They got all their land. Wrangell, that had always been a native village, one of the oldest in the state, one of the most powerful before white men contacted southeast Alaska, they're denied. Because he had left on the list by some people that happened to be seated in Washington, D.C. And now we're going to perpetuate this?
That's really disappointing if somebody couldn't possibly recognize the unfairness of treating people like that.
I might add, Senator, that when when that provision was added to the federal welfare reform law, our administration played virtually no role in that. It was really a federal decision, really driven more by reservations than in the lower 48 than so much of the village. Our congressional delegation just made sure the last many villages were included. I think it's recognized by many people, even the Native community, that it is a double-edged sword. That when you say that, if you live in a Native village, you don't have a time limit anymore, it takes the pressure off for them to find work opportunities in rural Alaska to do the economic development, everything else that's necessary. So, on the other hand, if there are no jobs in the area, then, how fair is it to those families to cut them off over the assistance when there's no other alternative for support? So, it is a double-edged sword. It's a difficult issue. I think it's something that ought to be considered when the TANF law gets reauthorized by Congress.
What about the idea of the bond that someone who, I mean, I don't know if that's bizarre, or maybe there's a flight operator or something, or a fuel service, or...
That's possible. I actually think there's probably a lot more that we can do, frankly, to get folks in the villages doing something to contribute to the community. Whether in the schools, as we all know, are probably the big employers in rural and small villages. And my sense of it is that either on our part or on the part of the school districts, we can do a better job of using that employer in that community to provide at least training opportunities or work experience opportunities for recipients.
We have 7 minutes now to finish
And with that in mind, I see the number two here, performance standards for staff and contractors, and one of the real things in it. And then the third one, performance-based contracting, where you're rewarding the contractors for getting people into jobs as opposed to the number of cases they handle, is a genius idea that probably has some problem implication. as I understand it from conversations with Sandy, that was a wonderful wave of new contractor enthusiasm for getting people to work. And I, with the chair's response, I would really like to hear from you that you guys, well, in the best of all worlds, are true believers and will go down that road for rewriting the contracts that reward the contractor's performance and getting people off welfare, and that you follow her suggestion here, which is that they not be multi-year contract guaranteed, but 1 year, and if they are quite successful at getting people to work, or, you know, and so on, that continual renewing of the contract is based upon performance.
Those next several
of them do seem to be kind of intertwined. Yeah, they are. And let me just say that, particularly in the interest of time, we take to heart those recommendations. And frankly, those are the things that we're most enthusiastic about in this report. And we do plan to, number one, we're going to hire consultants to help us basically make improvements to our case management system. And that one of the key issues there is to making true performance measures that work with associated penalties and bonuses, both our own staff in the case management, and for 60% of the temporary assistance case management in the state is done by outside organizations, nonprofits. But to create those true performance measures for that, and actually I had a handout here that I wanted to share with you. These are basically the essential elements to what we're going to be looking at from a consultant to help us with to implement these changes.
Okay. Okay, Sandy, do you want to kind of wrap up your comment on these and see if we can?
Yeah, I think as I'm looking through the rest of the list, we've touched on these one way or another. I think the management issues and Jim has been very open and receptive to these recommendations really have to do with accountability and strengthening the whole accountability process. I do think they could increase the utilization of worksite training, and to the issues that the senator was expressing in the villages, they certainly could be doing more community service type out there. We talked about streamlining child care. You've already discussed that. Availability of providers for infant and extended child care. I believe they should merge the food stamp program into the DPH policy unit. The issue here is that you've got differing philosophies between these two programs around the importance of employment, and I think there needs to be a common philosophy, and the easiest way to do that would be to merge those units. And then we did see some accountability problems with some Native Alaskan grantees. We want to be real careful there that it was not uniform by any means, but probably need to keep working on how you get more accountability with the Native Alaskan grantees. So I think we've hit on the high points.
Okay, I have been given a question to ask, and then we'll ask you, are there any states that distribute welfare benefits and no interest loans versus just outright grants? Is there any other system that you can use where you require participation now and repayment or partnering in any way with folks who come in and ask for assistance?
You know, with Sandy's scope being a little broader than mine, she might be a better person to answer that question. I not that I know of. I know it's something we talked about, years ago when we were working on your bill. One of the first thoughts is just the administrative requirements of setting loans and repayments and all that would be for essentially poor folks who do not really be able to pay anyway. Just, I don't know if it would be worth the effort, but maybe Sandy has something to say.
Sandy,
do you
know anything on that?
No, I don't know of any state that goes there. There are some different incentive things states do around the diversion thing, like offer very low interest or housing loans, or loans for cars, that kind of thing as incentive for people to take that versus coming under the cash grant program. But a loan to pay back the welfare benefits, I don't know of any state that's doing that.
Okay. Thank you. Are there other questions for Donald and Marcus and I'm sure we'll be having many, 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 many more conversations for this as well. Yes,
I just wanted to thank Sandy and her group, particularly for the tremendous effort they put in assisting this legislature and specifically this committee, and also Jim and his staff and the Department of Education. I believe there has been a sincere, conscientious, professional effort to get around some of these problems, and honestly, it's been one of the most fulfilling things I've watched in 17 years in the legislature, because for the first time, I saw government really trying to do something that, in my mind, was fulfilling and beneficial to the people we serve, not just continuing to sit in an office, gin up files, and hand out checks. All of a sudden, we were taking an interest in the person themselves and how that person and their family might be benefiting by getting away from this system of dependency that we government had created in the first place. And I really take my hat off to all of you. I think you've done a wonderful job, and I want to be one of those people who encourages you in every way I can and assists you in every way I can to carry that out, because I think it's a much better thing we're doing today than what we were doing just a year or 2 years ago, and I want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
Just three quick kind of business things that I want to identify with Senator Taylor's remarks. As I watched the folks out here in the audience, I saw a lot of people nodding heads. Now, I suspect that there's quite a few out here, either as a recipient or an administrator or a service provider, have seen some of these problems. And that was kind of neat. If there's anybody here who says that knows that some of this won't work, I'd like to hear from you. I think we, the legislators here, owe it to ourselves to maybe Senator Green and I should work on this. Get somebody on our staff to convert these things and this recommendations here into missions and measures modifications that we work on in the budget process, and that we ought to set ourselves a firm line to talk with Mr. Norman about a year from now, first at the end of the legislation session, and a year from now, to get a report on how much progress we've made and what remains undone. I suspect a year from now we're going to have a sea change here, you know, in terms of some administrative people and some legislators. And if this project here has been as good as Senator Taylor has just said, and I think it is, we need to do our job of getting all these changes well underway and institutionalized so that they happen, even with a change of the guard. You know, and you all have more experience than me. Yep.
Thank you very, very much for your time and energy. I tell you what, Kate, is your presentation going to take a 4 hour? Okay. We're going to take about 5 minutes, because when you're doing this one hour, a lot of people, I can see, I am the hallway there, and then by the way, there is coffee in here. So we'll be back here at 11.
Okay. She didn't take break time.
As soon as the recorder gets turned on here, are we ready?
Nope.
Okay. Okay. And so we will go ahead and begin this segment, and this question will go until 11:30, which time we will hear from comments about the certificate of need. Unless we get some more air in here, that door is going to have to be open. Have they requested that door be closed from Aurora?
This one?
Mm-hmm. Okay, unless we get some more air in here, that door has to be open, and we have to have air from that front door to this back door, or I'm going to expire. I think I'm going to have a lot of company. There are way too many BTUs being emitted here. Could you guys do something about that? Anyway, and I know we've all heard, as a result of the events of the conversation has changed, and I know we referred to it yesterday, Karen, about the purpose and the aims and the goals, and everything you're doing is probably taking a dramatic change and switch, and that does impact the cost of doing business. And certainly, I'm very concerned about this year's discussions and how everything filters down from the federal government to the state of Alaska, what your charge is, what your mission is. I mean, you may have things that are number one priorities this year that are no longer your priority. And what does that do to our conversations? And certainly, as your budget is impacted by health and social services, and then and if you have a Medicaid tie that's interesting, but we could not resist having comments and bringing input to this discussion for this episode time. So I will turn it over to you, and you can introduce yourself and your guests and speakers, and now that we have all these doctors in the room, I don't want to be on their best behavior. Go ahead, Karen.
For the record, I'm Karen Pearson, and I'm the Director of Public Health, and I asked two of our really key staff in the whole bioterrorism effort to come in and speak with me today, too, because I think there's nothing that will help you understand where we are and how things are working, except to hear from the people who are doing that work. And Dr. Beth Funk is immediately to my left here, and she's a physician and manages the infectious disease control effort within the Division of Public Health, and as you would guess, has been very busy these last few weeks taking calls, giving the direction. And Dr. Lynn Luscher is a PhD physician, not a physician, and she is the person who has been directing and actually doing the lab testing on all the specimens that have come to our lab. So I'd like to just give you a little background about what our world has been for the last few weeks, and then ask Beth and Lynn to just give you a little bit of what their routine has been and how they have refocused, you know, exactly the things that you talked about, Senator, because our world is dramatically different in public health, just as everybody's is personally with the events after September 11th. First, I'd like to just say a thank you to all of you here and your colleagues in the legislature, because had you not been out in the forefront and helped us have some of the things that we have in place, our ability to respond on behalf of Alaskans these last few weeks would have been dramatically different. And I have to tell you that one night I just sat up in bed, you know, sort of in this wide awake standing with, what would we have done if this had been October last year and we had not moved into our new lab facility? Because we did not have bio-level safety, 3-level capacity in our old lab. We would have been in the situation of having to get Alaska specimens down to another state and then queued up behind all of their own efforts. So thanks to all of you for the roles that you played in helping us have that new lab in place and ready to go. Thanks also for your support. I know when we came to you about 3 years ago and asked for federal authority to accept CDC bioterrorism prevention money, all of us thought that was kind of a stretch, you know, that, you know, how likely was this to happen? And you believed in us when we said that, you know, this information was really, this money was needed to get an information structure in place that we could use for our regular disease reporting, education, lab capacity, epidemiological capacity. So again, that meant that a lot of things were in place. And out of that came something that I would share with you, because obviously you're just hearing from us in health on bioterrorism today. But I think all of us in Alaska have been well served by the work of all the departments that have come together, because obviously it's public safety, it's military and veterans affairs, you know, everybody. And for us in health, those were new partners that Lynn and Beth and all the rest of our staff, as we used our bioterrorism money to figure out who needed to be talking to whom, should something happen, doing the drills, those kinds of things, all of our public health staff got to know and develop relationships with all of these people in these other departments. And so when we suddenly all had to come together very quickly, especially after the anthrax, because that's when everything really hit high gear for us, all of these people knew each other, They knew what the roles were, and so they very quickly, with some help from us at the department level, through the disaster policy cabinet, and those of us working at that level, could get protocols in place, and everybody knew, you know, okay, when I contact this person, here's how it's going to work. And the system was built as an overlay on our existing system. When we got together and said, okay, how do we let communities know what to do should they find, you know,